If we could get the lights down again.
Thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me to give a presentation here. I want to talk about time in quantum mechanics, a particular version of quantum mechanics known as Bohmian mechanics. Bohmian mechanics can be regarded as a set of axioms for quantum mechanics, different from the conventional axioms, which I wrote down here. Conventional axioms would consist of the Schrödinger equation, or maybe a relativistic version thereof, for a wave function that is defined on configuration space, takes values either in the complex numbers or in some spin space, or may for some whatever other reason have several components. So the Schrödinger equation is what holds, or how the wave function evolves while the system is closed, and it's complemented by a second postulate, the measurement postulate, which says that if an observer measures a particular observable associated with self-adjoint operator A, which is given here in the spectral decomposition where alpha are the eigenvalues and p alpha are the corresponding projections, then the probability distribution is given by this formula, and the wave function collapses after the measurement according to this rule where t plus zero means immediately after t. Now, there are various reasons to be dissatisfied with this set of axioms, because one reason is it involves kind of vague concepts like observer or measures. It's not completely clear when exactly this measurement postulate is supposed to be applied. But also, many people feel that postulates about what observers see, while maybe being true statements, should not be the fundamental kind of physical laws. So here's a different set of axioms for quantum mechanics that has a realist flavor. It is a set of axioms that talks about a hypothetical reality that proposes a certain story about what might be taking place. Again, it uses the Schrödinger equation without a change. Well, maybe with this change that it actually takes the Schrödinger equation to be valid even for the wave function of the universe, not just of a system. And it assumes that particles are actually particles in the literal sense, that they're point-like objects moving around in space, that they have a position at every time. So qk of t, that's the position of particle number k. Q of t, that's the configuration of all particles together. This configuration changes with time according to a particular law, an equation of motion, which is of this structure, the quantity usually known as the probability current associated with the wave function psi. You take the k component of that, that means corresponding to particle number k, divided by the what is usually regarded as the probability density, psi squared. Evaluate that at the actual configuration q of t, or more explicitly for non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that's the expression. The next assumption is that the configuration has the psi squared distribution at every time. Well, when we talk about the configuration of the entire universe, then it's appropriate to replace the notion of probability distribution by that of typicality. So a somewhat more refined, more sophisticated way of saying that is that the configuration Q of t should be typical relative to this measure on the configuration space of the universe. In many practical cases, however, it just boils down to the configuration being random. It's just the psi squared distribution. actually, as a postulate, this can only be postulated for one t, because once you fix the initial position of all particles, then this differential equation for the configuration, since it is a first order in time, determines the entire future trajectory. So you have no choice anymore about the future configuration. And actually, it is a fact that this hypothesis is consistent. If you assume it for one time, it automatically holds for every other time. This fact is known as equivariance. Theories of this type have actually been proposed several times in history. Maybe the first one was Slater in 1923. I think the first one who really appreciated the value of this theory was Bohm in 1952. This version, how I write it down here, is due to John Bell in 1966. Here's an example of these Bohmian trajectories. So this is about the double slit experiment. Here's the double slit, upper slit, lower slit. The wave function is not drawn. You know what the wave function looks like. The trajectories that are drawn here are alternative trajectories. The actual particle, if you run only one particle through the double slit device, only follows one trajectory, of course. What you can see here in this picture nicely is how the trajectories tend to go where psi squared is large and tend to avoid places where psi squared is small. That is just a consequence of the covariance property that I mentioned before. You can also nicely see how the double slit experiment is explained in this theory. The particle actually always arrives at a particular spot, and this particular spot is psi squared distributed. In particular, this spot depends on the wave function. And in particular, it depends on the fact that the other slit was open. So here, wave-particle duality is taken literally. The wave, there's a wave, and there's a particle. The wave passes through both slits. And that's how the particle learns about the fact that the other slit is open, and so it learns how to avoid certain spots on the screen. One of the advantages of Bohmian mechanics is that it allows an analysis of quantum measurements. With the usual axioms, quantum measurements are taken as primitive, unanalyzable, or unanalyzed. Here you can study quantum measurements. And a basic result of this study is that Bohmian mechanics actually implies the quantum formalism in the sense the statistics that observers would find in their experiments actually agree with the predictions of quantum mechanics. In this sense, Bohmian mechanics is an explanation of quantum mechanics, though, in the words of John Bell, an unromantic one. A particular consequence of this is that these nice experiments that Lev likes to think up that sound very paradoxical actually are not paradoxical, because Bohmian mechanics always gives you a way of thinking about these paradoxes, of reproducing exactly these paradoxical outcomes that are consistent, coherent, because they're just special cases of Bohmian mechanics. Another property of Bohmian mechanics, it's time symmetric. More precisely, that means the following. Consider a particular solution of the equations of Bohmian mechanics. So that is a wave function obtained by solving the Schrödinger equation. This is a configuration obtained by solving Bohm's equation of motion for this wave function. Now, given this solution, you turn it into another solution by time reversing it. That means you just, for the trajectories, it's clear what that means. For the wave function, in addition, you have to take the complex conjugate, If psi has many components, you do it component-wise, and then actually this turns out to be another solution of the equations of Bohmian mechanics. In addition, also the probabilities behave in the right way, because for the reverse process still, the probabilities are given by psi of minus t squared. So that's a time symmetric theory which does not invoke or lead for the goal of being time symmetric any two-state vector formalism or anything further propagating into the past, or any form of retrogradation for that matter. Of course, there's an arrow of time, like thermodynamic arrow of time in this theory, but it comes not from a fundamental time asymmetry in the equations of the theory, but rather it comes, as in classical mechanics, from the specialness of the initial conditions. And since the initial configuration can be regarded as random, what counts here is the initial wave function. Actually, the initial wave function is special, is different from wave functions at late times, and that's how the arrow of time arises. The big question is whether that can be done in a relativistic way, and the answer is maybe a bit disappointing. In order to construct a version of Bohmian mechanics in a relativistic space-time, we need to make an assumption that goes against the spirit of relativity. What we assume is the existence of a time foliation. That word means a physical object mathematically represented by a space-like foliation of space-time. That means a slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. Let me draw an example of that. So let this be space-time. T could be flat or curved. A foliation means a set of space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that they don't intersect, and altogether they cover all points of space-time. Suppose such an object exists, and now we use that for defining the temporal order of space-like separated events. That is, if you look at these two events are space-like separated, but using the time foliation, we would say that this event is later than this, because there's a time leap that is in between the two. Of course, we keep the Lorentzian metric on space-time, so we don't destroy the structure, the relativistic structure, or the Lorentzian structure of space-time. We just add a structure, and in this setting, Bohmian mechanics possesses an analog, in fact, a rather straightforward analog on this on the curved or flat manifold using the Dirac equation. This leads to the question whether there is a possibility that there might exist a version of Bohmian mechanics that is actually compatible with the spirit of relativity. For Bohmian mechanics, such a version is unknown. My personal belief is it's unlikely. Many people have tried to find such a version, and it's nowhere in sight. If you're dissatisfied with this kind of time foliation, then there is an alternative, though. There's another realist quantum theory known as GRW theory. That stands for Girardi, Rimini, Weber. The letter F stands for the flash ontology. That refers to an ontology where the matter in space-time is not represented by word lines as in Bohmian mechanics, but rather by discrete points. These points are called flashes. And such a theory can, in fact, be done without the use of a time foliation or any other additional object that would be against the spirit of relativity. My personal view is that the addition of a time foliation may well be a price worth paying. So let me go on with Bohmian mechanics. There are some, well, given that Bohmian mechanics gives such a different attitude about all kinds of questions about quantum mechanics, of course, it also gives a different attitude, different answers about all sorts of questions concerning time and quantum mechanics. Here are some points about time that I would like to address briefly. Many of them are just trivial points, but simple points. My first point concerns time measurements. By that, I mean the following. I mean a measurement that measures the time when a detector clicks. So think of a quantum particle surrounded with detectors. So sooner or later, one of the detectors click, and we just stop the stopwatch when it clicks. So that's what I mean by a time measurement. This kind of experiment is kind of difficult to treat quantum mechanically, because there is no operator associated with this kind of measurement. Now, I claim that this puzzle can actually be solved in Bohmian mechanics. Once I've said something about the kind of more fundamental question in Bohmian mechanics, why do operators play a role at all? Given that the fundamental formulation of the theory doesn't mention operators in any way, except perhaps the Hamiltonian operator in the Schrödinger equation. Here's the answer to that. How do the operators come into Bohmian mechanics? It's a theorem about Bohmian mechanics that for any experiment on a system with Hilbert space H, there's a problem E acting on H, such that if the system has a wave function psi, then the probability of an outcome in the set delta is given by this kind of expression. Now, there are some terminology that needs explaining. First of all, problem. Problem, well, that's a mathematical notion that maybe many of you are not familiar with. It means positive operator valued measure on a set omega. So that means that with any subset of omega, we associate a positive operator on the Hilbert space in such a way that for the biggest subset, the entire space, we associate the unit operator, the identity, and in such a way that this family of operators is additive in the sense that whenever you form a union of pairwise disjoint operators, of pairwise disjoint sets, then the corresponding operators add. So that works much like a probability measure, except that it's operator valued. In fact, whenever you have a problem and sandwich it between two copies of a vector psi with norm 1, then this expression defines a probability measure, a probability distribution on the space omega. So these are kind of the simplest way in which you could get probability distributions from a psi. And it's a general fact that can be proved in Bohmian mechanics, because in Bohmian mechanics you can analyze measurements, so you can prove theorems about what happens there, that the statistics of the outcome is always given by a problem. A special case of these problems is the one where the base phase is the real line and the operators are projections. This case corresponds to a self-adjoint operator in the following sense. The projection associated to a set is just the sum of the some of the just the spectral projection associated to the set delta, that is the sum of the projection operators associated with all the eigenvalues in the set delta. So what do we learn from that about the question of time operators? Well, first of all, there is a problem, even though there is no self-adjoint operator for time, there is a problem for the time of arrival, or the time of detection. So there is a problem on the half line for the statistics of the time of detection. Now, operators as observables are attributed a special status, an almost metaphysical meaning in orthodox quantum mechanics, but not at all in Bohmian mechanics. In Bohmian mechanics, problems are just mathematical tools for encoding probability distributions, and self-adjoint operators correspond just to a special case of problems, namely the projection value ones. Thus, in Bohmian mechanics, it is not particularly surprising that there is no time operator, because there was no reason in the first place to expect there was a time operator. There was only reason to expect that there is a time problem, which is actually the case. Another very trivial point that you can immediately make straightforwardly from a Bohmian perspective concerns tunneling time. So the question here is, consider a tunneling situation. You have a barrier, and a particle is sent into that barrier, has a certain probability of being reflected, a certain probability of tunneling through. Given that it did tunnel through, the question is, how long did the particle stay inside the barrier? To this question, several answers have been proposed in the literature, some of them implying faster than light motion. Enders and Nimtz have claimed they have transmitted a Mozart symphony faster than light. Some of these proposals lead even to negative tunneling times, which seems even less credible. In Bohmian mechanics, there's only one reasonable, straightforward, obvious definition of the tunneling time. Well, you read it off from the trajectory. You look at the trajectory of a particle and read off from it how much time it actually spends in the barrier region. Couldn't be simpler. This, by the way, obviously does not lead to negative tunneling times. And by the way, it also does not lead to superluminal speed inside the barrier. Another question that's one of the, I guess, many problems of time in quantum gravity. How can it be that the wave function that appears in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is time independent? If the wave function is time independent, doesn't that mean that nothing moves? Doesn't that mean that everything is static? Isn't that in an obvious contradiction to what we see around us? In Bohmian mechanics, the answer is straightforward, because in Bohmian mechanics, the wave function is not everything. What exists in Bohmian mechanics, the ontology, consists of two things, particles and the wave function. And if the wave function is time independent, if it's constant as a function of time, then the particle configuration need not be constant as a function of time, and likewise, perhaps for the space-time metric. Okay, very simple point. Now, I'd like to move on to some other questions that are more intricate concerning the arrow of time. The first question I'd like to address is the following. Are quantum measurements evidence of time asymmetry rather than of macroscopic irreversibility? Let me explain what I mean by that. By time asymmetry, I mean of a fundamental violation of microscopic time symmetry. Whereas by irreversibility, I mean the kind of thing that happens in thermodynamics, where things are microscopic and are irreversible, even though you know that on a microscopic level, so that means this macroscopic irreversibility, well, we know from classical mechanics, we need to know that this comes from the initial state of the system. So in classical mechanics, we see, oh, if the initial state of the system is special, then we get this macroscopic irreversibility, even though we have time symmetry on the fundamental level. So the question here is, is it possible that, or can we argue that in quantum mechanics this must be different? Well, we know that the Schrödinger equation is reversible, but in the conventional axioms of quantum mechanics, we have, besides the Schrödinger equation, also the measurement postulate, which at least on the surface sounds time asymmetric. So the question here is whether we can actually prove time asymmetry of quantum measurements. And one person who has defended that is the great Roger Penrose in his beautiful book, The Road to Reality. He has argued, yes, indeed, he believes that the fundamental laws of physics should be time asymmetric. He also believes this should be connected to quantum gravity, and that this should be connected to the collapse of the wave function. But aside from that, here is a specific argument that he gives. The argument goes as follows. Suppose there is a photon source S, which emits single photons one at a time, aimed at a beam splitter, angled at 45 degrees, so that half of the wave packet moves in this direction, half of the wave packet moves in this direction. If a photon is transmitted through, then it activates the detector D. While if it is reflective, then it gets absorbed in the CDC. Now imagine this particular experiment backwards in time, given that there is a detection event at D, at the detector. Then we argue, oh, that would correspond to a wave packet going back, being split into two wave packets here, one passing through, one being reflected. Now, that is backwards in time. Okay, as we proceed backwards in time, being reflected. So that this other wave packet would have come from the floor air. And you can feel that we would find a probability of 50% for emission at the source S, and 50% for the photon come from the floor air. This, that a photon came from the floor at just the right time, the right kind of wave function, is an absurdity. That's completely the wrong answer. That, he concludes, shows that the quantum formalism actually implies, would give the wrong answer when applied in the other time direction. And from this, he concludes that there must be a time, fundamental time asymmetry. I think that this argument is not sound. In particular, Bohmian mechanics is a counterexample to that claim, because think again of what the claim was. The claim was there must be a time asymmetry in the fundamental laws. Now, in Bohmian mechanics, this is not the case. As I have shown to you, the fundamental equations of Bohmian mechanics are time symmetric. It's a time symmetric theory, and it correctly explains, or it explains correctly predicts the probabilities for such kind of experiments. Therefore, it cannot be true that any such experiment or any summary of the rules that govern the probabilities of such, of the outcomes of such experiments can be evidence for time asymmetry in the fundamental laws. So something must be wrong about this argument, and what was it? What went wrong? I believe what went wrong was that we need to include the detector in the quantum mechanical description, and that this was not done in the description before. So let's have a look at the wave function of particle and detector together. So this, the two axes here, they symbolize configuration space. Actually, configuration space has many, many dimensions. Three n dimensions where n is, I don't know, 10 to 23. I've drawn only two of these many dimensions here. This is one of the axes, one of the coordinates of the particle. By particle, I mean that one photon that we were talking about that travels through the beam splitter. And the other axis that refers to the position of one of the particles in the detector in such a way that when the detector is triggered, that this particle moves to some other place. So when the detector is triggered, say there's an electric current, so some electrons are actually moved to different places. At the initial time, t equals zero, at the beginning of the experiment, the wave function, the joint wave function of particle and detector, that can be assumed to be a product wave function. What I've drawn here represents the support of the wave function, that is the region where psi is appreciably non-zero. Now, let me evolve that with time. So now the particle passes the beam splitter. So far, the detector variable is unaffected, but in the particle coordinate, the wave packet has split into two wave packets, and time has increased from 0 to 5. Now, let's look at the detection event. In the detection event, suppose if the particle is over here, then the detector is triggered. If the particle is over here, the detector is not triggered. That means the following for the wave function in configuration space. It means that the right wave packet will move to a different place in configuration space, will move to a place in configuration space that corresponds to, that contains configurations in which the detector has been triggered. Whereas the other part of the wave function just stays where it is. Now, in Bohmian mechanics, I told you that the configuration always, at every time, has distribution of psi squared. Since psi squared is zero outside these two regions here, it means that the actual configuration must be in one of these two regions, either here or there, with appropriate probabilities. These probabilities actually agree just with the quantum mechanical prediction for where to find the particles. So in this example, they're just 50-50. Now, since the trajectory is continuous, and since the trajectory cannot pass through the region where the wave function is zero, that means that once the configuration was in the right wave packet at the time when the two wave packets split, it will remain in the right wave packet. It will end up here, and at this time, it's actually the motion of the configuration of all the particles is no longer affected by this other part of the wave function, which is therefore sometimes called an empty wave. Now, what would happen if we run this backwards? So that's the wave function at time h. We run this backwards. Since we just used the Schrödinger equation, of course, I just run the same movie backwards, and what we end up with is nothing like a wave packet coming from the floor, but exactly the initial wave packet that we started with. Now, let me go back here. Now, what Sir Roger said, of course, was that we conditionalize on the outcome being that the detector has gone off. Has been triggered. Now, that may suggest to take away this part of the wave function and replace the wave function by this one, with just one wave packet left, which corresponds to collapse of the wave packet. But actually, in Bohmian mechanics, the assumption is that the Schrödinger equation, or the wave function of the universe, holds without interruption. There is no collapse of the wave function, just the actual configuration stays in this part of the wave function. Now, as we let things evolve backwards, as long as we have both parts of the wave function there, actually also this configuration will move with this wave packet back into the same initial situation that it started with, same initial configuration, same initial wave function. Of course, if you collapse away one half of the wave function, you get a different result. If you assume that this is the wave function at time t equals 8, now you run this backwards. Okay, so here we undo the detection event. So the detector goes back into the untriggered configuration. Then we get this wave packet that travels. Now I'm playing here backwards in time, so this t value is reducing as wrong direction. T value is reducing. Now this wave packet passes the beam splitter, and as a consequence of that, it will end up with two wave packets, and in fact different ones than we started with. And here this would be the wave packet that actually ends up at time zero in the floor. This is the wave packet which I agree is an absurdity. Okay, so these were my comments on, well, let me again emphasize one thing. Let me emphasize what was the conclusion of this all. So while many parts of this argument are very trivial and may have led you to many thoughts, keep in mind the question I was talking about is whether this kind of situation, a quantum measurement, provides evidence or proof for the necessity of time asymmetry on the fundamental microscopic level. And Bohmian mechanics shows that this is not so. About the error of time, here's another topic concerning the error of time. That concerns Boltzmann's explanation for the thermodynamic error of time. Now I just mean thermodynamic error of time. So Boltzmann gave an explanation in the classical setting, and the question I want to address is, what about the transfer of this explanation into quantum mechanics? To focus ideas, let us just think of this particular situation where we put two bricks next to each other, so they're in thermal contact, one of them is hot, cold. What will happen? They will both approach similar temperatures, so that the high temperature goes down, the low temperature goes up. Now this is connected, the reason, and that is what we want to explain. Why does it happen this way? The reason is connected to the second law of thermodynamics, the increase of entropy. So that brings us to the question, what's the appropriate definition of entropy? Now there are two kinds of definitions of entropy around. One is the entropy of an ensemble, and the other, entropy of an individual system. The entropy of an ensemble, that's one that is, I think, considered more often, but I think that for our purposes, the one that's relevant is the entropy of an individual system. What is that like? Entropy of the ensemble here. Classically, the ensemble is described by a probability distribution, rho over phase space, or rho is the probability density. And with that distribution, we can associate this value, call it the Gibbs entropy. It measures roughly the width of this probability distribution. And a quantum analog of that is to consider a density matrix as may arise, for example, from a probability distribution over wave functions, and have this quantity, which also measures sort of how wide the distribution is. The problem with these notions of entropy is there are several problems. One is this quantity actually does not increase with time. It remains constant under the Schrödinger evolution. So it can only increase by interaction with the environment, subsequently trace out the environment, or by force grading, or by letting time go to infinity, then this may actually weakly converge to some more spread out probability distribution. But all of these things don't seem very relevant to explaining the thermodynamic error of time, because, well, we actually don't wait for an infinite amount of time until two temperatures become equal. It is only a matter of minutes. It seems a case that even if the system consisting of the two bricks does not interact with any outside environment, it would occur that the two temperatures become equal. And coarse grading, also that doesn't seem relevant. But above all, the problem with these notions of entropy of an ensemble is they seem inappropriate in Bohmian mechanics, where there exists observer-independent truth. Let me explain what I mean by that. These entropy ensembles may appear natural in ordinary quantum mechanics, where you tend not to believe anyway that there are any facts about what the system really is. But in Bohmian mechanics, the system really is like something. It has a definite configuration at the time, a definite wave function at any time. So what matter could it play? How much an observer knows about it or can know about it? It seems to me that it can play no role at all. That is, to put it differently, this evolution where the temperatures of the two bricks become equal, that's just a matter of these evolution equations. This fact would be equally true to an angel that actually knew exactly what the wave function of the entire system is, or knew what the configuration is. So what seems relevant here is the entropy of an individual system, which means the following. Here's the classical version introduced by Boltzmann. You consider macrostates, that is, sets of phase points that look macroscopically similar. And so these sets, let me call them gamma nu. So nu is a particular macrostate, gamma nu, the corresponding subset of phase space. We regard this as a partition of phase space. So any point in phase space lies in one and only one of these sets. And then the Boltzmann entropy of a particular macrostate, that's Boltzmann constant times the log of the volume of that macrostate. And the quantum analog of that would be the macrostates, as John von Neumann has argued in his book on the foundation of quantum mechanics. The different macrostates correspond to orthogonal subspaces of the Hilbert space in such a way that the entire Hilbert space is an orthogonal sum of these different subspaces. Then the analog of Boltzmann's definition of entropy would be to take Boltzmann constant times log of the dimension of that subspace corresponding to a particular macrostate. Now, that works well classically, but there's a problem with it in quantum mechanics, or in Bohmian mechanics for that matter. Classically, the phase point typically moves to larger and larger cells, gamma nu. That's why the entropy increases. That's very nicely illustrated in this drawing, which I took from Roger Penrose's beautiful book, The Road to Reality. So we are now here So this sheet here, that's phase space. And you see here the various macrospace, these cells, that's the equilibrium macrospace, the biggest one. There are other cells, here's a cell, here's a cell, here's a cell. That's the present cell, there are smaller cells. The small cells actually are much, much smaller than the big cells. Now the phase point is moving around in this picture in a rather complicated way. And if this complicated motion is not contrived, then the phase point will actually tend to move to larger and larger cells. Fine. So that's Boltzmann's explanation of the thermodynamic error of time based on the entropy of individual systems. Now, the problem with doing the same trick in quantum mechanics is the following. Classically, every microstate, as described by writing down all the positions and all momenta, all particles, belongs to one and only one macrostate. And so it has an unambiguous entropy value, namely just the entropy of that macrostate. But in the quantum case, most microstates, psi, most wave functions, do not belong to any of these macrostates, to any of these subspaces, and so don't have any entropy value, because the entropy values are associated with these subspaces. An example of this is Schrödinger's cat. Schrödinger's cat has a quantum state psi, which is a superposition of contributions from two different subspaces in H set mu, namely corresponding to a dead cat and a live cat. Now, it seems reasonable to assume that a dead cat has a higher entropy than a live cat. That's why there is irreversible. And so Schrödinger's cat is in a superposition of two different entropy values. This is a point where the foundations of quantum mechanics touch with the foundations of statistical mechanics. So in this situation where you can have superpositions of different microstates and the superpositions of different entropy values, what sense could even make to say that the entropy increases with time, taking that entropy means the log of the dimension of the subspace that you're in? It doesn't make sense because you are not in a subspace. Now, here's where Bohmian mechanics helps. In Bohmian mechanics, there's a fact about whether Schrödinger's cat is alive or dead. So what happens to Schrödinger's cat in Bohmian mechanics is, even though the wave function is a superposition, the configuration is either that of the dead cat or one of the live cat. So here, when the configuration is actually that of a live cat, we would say the cat is actually alive, and then we would say, oh, entropy is the entropy associated with that macrostate of a live cat. So that corresponds to the following mathematical expression. The entropy given the complete state description in Bohmian mechanics, that means the configuration and the wave function, is that value S mu for which Q lies in the support of the contribution to psi from that macrospace. Here P sub mu means the projection to that subspace. Q does actually not always select unique macrostate mu, unless a unique entropy, but it does so in practical and relevant cases. So you can easily think of cases where two macrostates actually overlap in configuration space, but this is not much of a practical problem. Now, what needs to be done in order to repeat Boltzmann's explanation of the error of time in Bohmian mechanics? So on the one hand, we have this ingredient here, how the configuration actually selects an entropy value. But then, of course, we also need some statement about Schrödinger evolution, how it moves from
Well, what the Schrödinger evolution does to move from smaller to larger subspaces. And about this, I want to describe a conjecture. And I will describe this conjecture first in a pictorial way. This diagram, the axes are the following. Here, there are the various macrospaces. Okay, at this point, there's only one symbol here. So what you place along the horizontal axis are various macrospaces ordered by the entropy values. For any particular macrospace, such as this one, we put here in the histogram a bar showing the size of the contribution to the state vector from that macrospace. So in general, we will have many bars. We may have a complicated histogram. A typical wave function will have contributions from many of these subspaces. And what is shown in the histogram is how strong the different contributions are. So in this picture, we're starting with a wave function that lies entirely in one of these macrospaces. That's why there's only one bar. Now, we want to evolve this with time. And what we would like to see is that for such a wave function, we at later time don't get any contributions with smaller entropy, only contributions with higher entropy. And here's my conjecture for about what that might look like. What did we see here? So this was the initial macrostate here. And to macrostates with much smaller entropy, there's basically zero contribution. For macrostates with a little smaller entropy, there might be a small contribution. That's because you would also classically expect that sometimes you have fluctuations. So also for this situation, you would expect there are some small contributions, smaller entropy, but essentially all of the psi squared weight from this macrospace has moved to other macrospaces with higher values of entropy. Now, this is still an open research project, but I think that this conjecture, together with using the Bohmian trajectories, that could allow us for actually formulating a quantum analog of Boltzmann's explanation of the thermodynamic era of time. Here's a verbal formulation of that conjecture under appropriate conditions, which should be satisfied in realistic conditions. And considering a macrostate mu prime whose entropy, in the sense I defined before, namely the logical dimension of the corresponding subspace, is less than the entropy of mu, then for a typical initial wave function in this macrospace H mu, and for any time positive, actually, or negative, for this statement, the difference, the size of the contribution in that other macrospace, smaller dimension, is small. And it seems like this conjecture together with Bohmian mechanics could lead to the increase of the sort of Bohmian quantum entropy with time. While, on the other hand, this conjecture alone is not capable of proving anything like entropy increase. The conjecture alone does not prohibit entropy decrease. Why is that? Let me explain it. So what the conjecture says is that if at time zero, we start completely in this one macrostate, typical wave function from that subspace. Then for any later, or if you wish, earlier time, the contribution from other, from macrospaces with smaller entropy will be small. But this is only a statement that refers to one time at a time. It does not refer to anything like a history over time. Okay, and here's an example that illustrates why such a statement cannot imply anything like any statement about the history, like entropy increase over the history. Suppose that in an airport building, there are 5,000 passengers at every time t, and furthermore that at every t, 5 passengers undergo the security check. That is a small fraction, 10 to the minus 3. So the idea here is, in this example, it is true for every time t that a fraction of people are presently under scrutiny is small. But that doesn't mean that only a small fraction of people ever go through the security check. This fact does not contradict the statement that every passenger at some point undergoes the security check. So the analogy here is the security check would be a low entropy macrostate. And if we only have the statement that at every time the contribution from a low entropy macrostate is small, then this still does not exclude that in every single case you actually go through that low entropy macrostate, which is what we want to conclude. I think I've used up more time than I should have. Thank you very much for your time.
If we could have the lights again, that would be nice. Any questions?
Roger Penrose. I think I should really comment on your time-reversed example with the... I mean, when you take the initial state, you say the detector receives the photon, and in the Bohmian situation, of course, you're ignoring the fact that you've already retained the information about what the original state was by having the wave function split into those two pieces. I mean, in those circumstances, you'd only know where the particle was. I mean, it seems to me it's quite unfair to do it that way around. I mean, you're assuming the wave function is such that it's going to go back to the initial state where it's come out of the laser and not out of the floor.
The situation in Bohmian mechanics is this: there is a wave function of the universe, and it is whatever it is. So we don't know what
you don't know that. If you're using to predict...
Let me say it this way. There's a fact out there in the world of what the wave function is. So in a situation like this experiment, at time t equals 8, there's a fact about what the true wave function looks like. And the wave function here is not a device of what we write down mathematically to represent certain knowledge. There's just... a true wave function, and if it looks that way with two parts, then that's what it looks like.
Can I put it another way? You say that Bohmian mechanics is completely equivalent to quantum mechanics.
Makes the same prediction.
And whereas with quantum mechanics, yes, but this is a retrodiction. It doesn't make the same retrodictions. Is that what you're saying?
No.
It makes the same predictions, but different retrodictions. Because if you take the quantum mechanics together with the Born probability law, then you get the wrong answer for backwards evolution. But nobody ever does that, of course. So what you're saying is that if you adopt your procedure, which is that you're allowed to know what the wave function is at the future state, and you know that that wave function is going to get you back so that the thing comes out of the laser, well, okay, I mean, yes, that's what you're going to get back to because you've assumed it.
That sounds like you're saying, oh, you're misreading the quantum formalism. If you read the quantum formalism backwards, it actually says this and this.
which is something that,
you mean the, when
that
the,
actually is not confirmed by experiment and does not.
Just a minute. When you say the quantum formalism, when you say the quantum formalism, do you include the Born probability rule? Or just Schrodinger evolution? Oh, well, there's that. Well, then there's, of course, there's no time.
It's
no
relax of the wave
function. Okay, it could be in of the world, so there must be something like that involved in the mechanics as well.
Okay, let me quickly explain how it works. So you have these two wave patterns. And the actual configuration is in one of them. Now, these two wave patterns are disjoint in configuration space, they don't overlap, and they will never overlap again because they have actually so much disjoint, because we were actually assuming that they fit in a macroscopic way, not just this one particle, but remember that this axis here corresponded to the detector, which means many particles, so you will never arrange it in such a way as to make these two wave patterns overlap again. So that means that future motion on this configuration point actually depends only on this part of the wave function, not on that part of the wave function. That is why you get the right trajectories if from now on you forget about that part of the wave function and continue just with this part of the wave function. And the probabilities that you get in this way, using just this part of the wave function, are exactly the conditional probabilities when you use it in the future. Conditional probabilities, conditioning on the fact that the configuration point was in this region and not in that.
Okay. And you just told us that the future is quite symmetric, so it's not conditioned just to the future, it also has to be conditioned to the past. Otherwise, your formula is in fact symmetric. So,
what I said
in the past, under your rules that you gave us, that should also give us the right result.
What I said was that if you consider the future trajectory of this configuration, and you conditionalize the probability distribution of the fact that at time t equals 8, it was in my picture, it was in this region, then you get the same probability distribution.
Now condition it into the past. Now condition it into the past.
Yes.
So I condition that if t equals 8, I get that.
Yes.
What
is the question? What do you get? What do you get then at t equals 0? Okay.
You get conditioned on that.
Conditioned on that, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's an important question. So now if I start with this situation, I evolve it back into the past. Okay, what happens then at time 0? I have only 1. Wave packet here, and the spot representing the actual configuration will be the right color. That is what conditioning on that later configuration amounts to at time t equals 0. Does that answer your question? I think so. No.
Okay. It contradicts your statement that in Bohmian mechanics, the probability of finding the state at a particular point is proportional to psi squared at that point. And this
there's probability and conditional probability. Of course, if I condition on certain events, then my probability values change.
But the world is always conditioned on certain events.
But I think Robert Penrose wants to say this.
No,
I'm fine. He's got a louder voice.
He doesn't mean it.
I don't need to buy. Anyway,
just.
I'm not sure we should continue about this example, but I think that if you, in this example, this is exactly pre and post selected situation. So if you enforce thinking about one wave function, then you might have trouble, but thinking about two, everything is time symmetric.
Well, actually, the question was, as formulated in that
in that passage in your book was given that the detector has triggered, then what would be the probabilities, the conditional probabilities of that?
But you also given the source. So you know that it was no source there, so you are given that it's come from there, and it ended up from here. But
in a situation where money is open-ended at one end, then it doesn't. That's the problem. I mean, the way you normally use quantum mechanics is not with closed selection. So therefore, the reverse version is not with free selection.
But that doesn't seem to address the question, because the question was whether the probabilities that the observer experiment and the quantum mechanics predicts imply quantum mechanics. And it remains a fact that quantum mechanics is a counterexample to that. And it is independent of what one would believe to be the backwards reading of quantum mechanics.
I think you're making it much too complicated. It's very simple, what I was saying in there. I mean, there's nothing very... I mean, the probability is, if all you know is the final state, and you don't know what the initial state is, then you can't use the Born rule.
Of what?
Sorry?
The question is, what you know is the final state of what?
If I know that the final state of detector plus particle is this one, and I evolve it backwards in time, I get the right answer for time zero. If I assume that this is the final state, then I get the wrong answer.
That's right.
In quantum mechanics, there is a fact about what is the true wave function at any particular time. So it just so happens that this is the true wave.
Yes, but you're considering that you know what the wave function is at the end.
It is independent of what I know there is.
I think I've been told to ask a new question, a completely different one. Could you just expand it a little, Julian Barber, sorry, a little bit more about the Wheeler-DeWitt argument you had? I couldn't follow you on that. If you could possibly just say a bit more about it.
Yes. In the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you have basically this structure where psi is time independent. So it has the same structure as a time independent Schrodinger equation. Psi is not a function of time, it's a concept of time. Now, that appears strange. Maybe not to you, but to many people, it would, at least on the surface, seem like a contradiction to the fact that we see things move, that the physical state of the world is not time independent. Now, so this is time independent. Now, so this would normally seem like a problem, but it's not a problem from the Bohmian point of view, because in the Bohmian point of view, you don't insist that the wave function is everything. You admit that there are further variables, further entities in the world. For example, the configuration of particles. I could also imagine that for some Bohmian version of quantum gravity, you could have some, just like you have an actual configuration, you could have an actual metric. Okay? Now, even if psi itself is time independent, these quantities could be time independent. Even if their probability distribution at any t is the same probability distribution. Of course, as you know very well, that could be varying measures, so dynamical systems can be very non-trivial while having a certain probability distribution. So this could be time dependent, could move around in a very reasonable way, despite the fact that psi is time dependent.
That is then assuming there is a time and that these things are actually moving. So you are assuming an invisible absolute time. And also, I don't understand how the equation, you did also have an equation as well for it, which involves d psi by dt or something, if the psi doesn't depend upon t. But
well, I used this. So on one of the first slides, I used the same Schrödinger equation as the standard quantum mechanics. In such a context, it would be natural to use the same equation for the wave function as you would use in Hopper's version of the theory. So if for some reason you're convinced that that's the right equation for the wave function, you would use that equation.
I think maybe we'll be a little bit ruthless about not allowing follow-ups, just in the interest of time. I hope that's okay. So I'm going to move on to the next question, which is Dr. Biden, and then...
You briefly remarked that there are no paradoxes of the kind I presented. So the paradox I presented is that there is, from my point of view, strange situation. When you make this three box paradox, you have this beam splitters, and you quickly look where the particles, and you see that inside this inner interferometer, even though you don't see how they enter. Using Bohmian mechanics, they never enter this inner interferometer. But experiment, if you try to do this, will see that there is something there.
Yes.
So maybe you'll not see paradoxes, but then maybe it's not a good feature, because in this way you will not see real physical effects. And if I'm talking about time, you say that if you have a tunneling time or something, then it's well defined, you know exactly what it is. But it's not absolutely clear that it always corresponds to what we will measure in experiments.
Yes. The first question concerning the situation where of the particle that Lev described in his talk, where if a particular detector is triggered, then the particle actually never went through this computer. What did go through the computer, though, is part of the wave function. And it seems to me that the situation is very analogous to that of the double slit experiment, where, say, the particle went through the lower slit along one of these trajectories. And what it does, how it behaves, depends on the wave function, which also partly went through the upper slit. So the particle's trajectory is actually influenced by whether or not the upper slit is open or not. Likewise, in Lev's experiment, part of the wave function traveled through this computer, and then had an influence on how the particle that actually did not travel through the computer behaved. And that's because this part of the wave function influences the particle. So that's my answer to your first question. But then there was a second question concerning the tunneling time. You said it's you can't measure the time that the Bohmian particle spends in the air. That is, in a sense, true. If you try to measure it, you will actually modify the trajectory. The trajectory, when you measure the time when the Bohmian particle enters the barrier, and its future trajectory will not be the same as it would have been if it had not measured it. Okay, that's the way it is. But also, the question was not actually about any particular measured quantity. It was about the question of how much time the particle spends there.
I could say that a particle, no matter which variable, always spends 7 seconds. And you complain, but wait a minute, I go into it. No, when you measure it, you change everything. But if you don't measure it, always spends 7 seconds in there. So I don't know what your statement that the particle spends a certain amount of time in the variable means.
The difference here is your theory that the particle always spends 7 seconds in the barrier is just, not much of a theory. It doesn't explain much of our world. It's not physical theory. It's not based on any equations that you could be hoped to be universally valid. Whereas quantum mechanics has a set of equations that would actually correctly predict all of quantum mechanics. From the vast well of physical phenomena. Now that's the difference. You see, one theory is just something you just made up. The other theory is one that actually explains most of the visible world. Next question.
Hugh Price. Roddy, thanks for your talk. I wanted to go back to something you said close to the beginning. You said that the Bohm model was time symmetric, and then you said it wasn't retrocausal. I think that the latter part of that statement needs to be clarified a bit. I agree that it's not automatically retrocausal, but I think it can be retrocausal. It just depends on what the universal wave function is. If the universal wave function is something like Lev's backward evolving wave function, which the form of which depends on future measurements, then the resulting Bohm model will be retrocausal because our choices about what we measure in the future will affect certainly the wave function and probably also the particle trajectories in the past. And so the basic model seems to me to be perfectly compatible with retrocausal realizations.
That is correct. Even simpler example would be suppose that we can take the initial wave function of the universe and now put it as a final wave function and take the atomic summary and evolve it backwards. Then what we get is actually the entire world is still like backwards, and since in the normal situations we would say, that pause is now going to have an effect in the future, it must be so that in that situation, pause at any time would have effects in the past. About your more narrow suggestion that such a way from that you could meaningfully introduce that second state vector in Bohm mechanics.
I'm not talking about introducing a second state vector, just choosing a value for the first one, which has already got built into it the correlations with future measurements that Lev's second one has. So it's still a model with only one wave function, but the wave function has got the information in it about the future measurement settings.
I would say I'm skeptical about whether that could work. It's possible that the second wave function it seems unlikely to me that you could choose your boundary conditions and pass out the future in such a way that from the Schrödinger equation and all sort of leaving the equation to motion unchanged, you would actually get that out. You have the time foliation, and if that is the event where you do your first measurement on one half of the EPR pair, then this will have a causal influence on what happens if you do here your experiment on the second half of the EPR pair. So in a sense, you could say that these causes propagate along this lead. And in GRW theory, from that you don't have any such time leaps, you don't have any simultaneity. The GRW theory is a fundamentally stochastic theory, so that actually these points in space-time, they have a joint probability distribution, which is given by the theory. And this probability distribution has these non-local correlations built in. So if you conditionalize on this point being at a particular x and t, you will get some different probability distribution for where that point is. And that's something like a non-local influence, but actually it's symmetric between the two. It's just conditional probability.
Okay, when I'm getting the signal from the powers that be, our generous hosts, that it's time to conclude for dinner. But I'm committed to one more question because I've got the microphone and I promised it. So after that, we'll thank Dr. Tomolka and convene for dinner. Perfect way to end the first day, which is chomping at the bit for more discussion.
This is a question for clarification, Richard Healy. At one point, you claimed a theorem that for every experiment, there's a POVM. And if I put on my my bell hat, I say, what's an experiment? How can you prove it, theorems about experiments?
Thank you very much to Dr. Smith.